Now. Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. We push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Today, Putnam manages money for more than 9 million individual and institutional investors worldwide. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
We're at the point now where market volatility is itself a cliche. I mean, of course stocks tanked this morning after yesterday's 427-point loss, and then rebounded, and then ended down 444 more points. Isn't that the new definition of normal? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by CSX, working to reduce traffic and pollution by carrying the load of 280 trucks by rail. CSX, how tomorrow moves. Coverage of Asia is supported by the Freeman Foundation.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for joining us on this Thursday, the 20th day of November. If 400 and 500 point swings are the new normal, especially on the downside as we saw today, then it's going to be very difficult to answer the question that keeps popping up in this market era. How low can it go? Today, the S&P 500 fell to its lowest closing level since April of 1997. The Wilshire 5000 is down more than 50% from its high last October. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson peers into the crystal ball from New York.
There aren't a lot of investors willing to make predictions right now. They don't want to shoot too low and scare the markets, and they don't want to sound too Pollyannish. Peter Schiff, president of Euro-Pacific Capital, is a known doomsayer. The trouble is, he's been right about a lot. Here's his prediction for the Dow.
In 1980, the Dow was at 1 ounce of gold, and I certainly think it can do that again. Right now, the Dow is worth about 10 ounces of gold.
Schiff says that could happen if the Dow drops to 5,000 and gold jumps to $5,000 an ounce as investors flee to safety against inflation caused by all the bailout spending. And he says no stocks will be safe from a dramatic drop in consumer spending.
And I think a lot of U.S. companies are going to go out of business, and many of them that don't are going to dramatically downsize to reflect an American population that is much poorer and that spends a lot less money.
Charles Peabody of Portales Partners isn't quite as bearish. Still, he says his clients are fearful.
I think what you're seeing is a growing removal of participation in the markets, which means they become thinner and less liquid. And the thinner and less liquid they become, the more volatile. And that's very scary.
Peabody chalks up this week's losses to doubts about the government's ability to solve the crisis.
The marketplace knows that there are embedded losses in the system. And the question is, how are you going to apportion those losses?
He says investors want the government to bear the greater burden. So the Treasury's about-face on the bailout last week sent confidence on Wall Street plummeting. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
One of the other factors behind today's volatility was the continued backing and forthing over whether there will be some sort of rescue package for Detroit. Today, congressional leaders gave the Big Three 12 days to come up with a plan proving they're worthy of a bailout. It's not the only signal of a shift in power for the automakers. Today, California Democrat Henry Waxman ousted Michigan's John Dingell as chair of the House Energy and Commerce Committee. Marketplace's Elisa Roth has that story.
Congressman John Dingell's represented Michigan and the auto industry for decades. California's Henry Waxman has long been his rival, pushing for tougher industry standards on things like emissions.
This is symbolically a show that Michigan is losing power.
James Thurber directs the Center for Congressional and Presidential Studies at American University. He says Dingell really controlled the auto industry's agenda on the Hill.
He was so powerful that he could stop certain clean air legislation and minimum miles per gallon legislation. He really protected the industry, and he's no longer there anymore.
Dingell's departure happens to come at a do-or-die moment. Detroit is barely hanging on, and as the Big Three go, so do the United Auto Workers. Some say the timing of it all is coincidental. Thomas Mann is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, and he says that in today's economic and political climate, Detroit's problems go well beyond the scope of a congressional committee.
I really think it's a mistake to believe that in this economic and political environment that a committee chair is in a position to dramatically shape policy with respect to the auto industry right now.
Even so, if Congress manages to vote on a bailout before anybody goes bankrupt, Waxman could have an effect. Many say he'll force tougher standards into any agreement. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Last night on the other side of Capitol Hill, a bipartisan group of senators announced agreement on a bill that would temporarily change pension rules for U.S. companies. Right now, they have to make sure they have money on hand for a certain percentage of their pension obligations. But corporations are hoping to make some of that requirement go away. John Dimsdale reports from Washington.
2 years ago, Congress cracked down on underfunded pensions with a law requiring companies to speed up payments and eliminate shortfalls by 2015. Under that law, company contributions into defined benefit pension accounts would have to increase $90 billion this year. Now, a group of companies is backing a Senate bill to give them at least a year's respite from that requirement. The companies argue that in the midst of a recession, diverting scarce profits into pension plans means less money for investments and job creation. But actuary Jeremy Gold rejects the idea that pension contributions mean fewer jobs, since pension money is invested.
Contributions go into the pension plan, end up becoming new capital and new liquidity for other companies, and those very same dollars are then used to hire people throughout our economy.
Besides, Gold says allowing companies to shirk their pension obligations puts the government's already threatened pension insurance fund at greater risk. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac announced late today that they are suspending all foreclosure sales of occupied homes during the holidays. Happy news for homeowners, but didn't happen in time to stop the slide on Wall Street. We'll have details when we do the numbers. Today, GMAC announced that it wants to follow in the footsteps of American Express and become a bank. The largest lender to General Motors dealerships says it's hoping to become eligible for that $700 billion that Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson is doling out. University of North Carolina Professor Lisa Broom has been following these developments, and we've asked her to help us understand why anyone in their right mind would want to be a bank right now. Professor Broom, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So why are all these non-banks trying to become banks?
Well, I think there are probably three major reasons, the first of which is to have access to the bailout money through the TARP program. Reason number two is to have access to the Fed's discount window for short-term loans at the bargain rate now of 1.25%, so that's access to pretty cheap money. And number three is now, given the state of our economy and consumer uncertainty and investor concern, being regulated by the Federal Reserve Board, which bank holding companies are, may boost investor confidence and consumer confidence in the company.
You know, you mentioned regulation, and, you know, if you become a bank, you're certainly subjected to more regulation and, in some cases, restrictions than you are if you're not a bank. So what's the downside here for them?
Well, there's a substantial downside in terms of the nature of the other activities that your corporation and your corporation's parent may engage in. A bank holding company may only be engaged in activities that are closely related to banking. So if you're engaging in activities like selling cars, for instance, then those would be forbidden activities. As you become a bank holding company, you get a minimum of 2 years, which could extend up to 5 years to rid yourself of the non-conforming activities. So perhaps one thought is the short-run need is for this additional infusion of capital from the bailout fund, and 2 years down the road, we'll decide whether we want to stay as a bank holding company, and then we'll have to get rid of our non-conforming businesses, or whether we want to revert back to our prior status and we'll shed our bank at that point.
So then in practical terms, what does that look like for, say, GMAC? I mean, what do they get rid of? What do they gain?
Well, General Motors owns 49% of GMAC, mm-hmm. and so Right now, that would make General Motors also a bank holding company. And that would mean, you know, they can't make cars or sell cars anymore, or at least after this temporary period of 2 to 5 years expires.
So General Motors really just has to get rid of a lot of its stake in GMAC, or a car company becomes a bank.
Or they could play this waiting game and say, we have become a bank holding company by our affiliation now with this thing that just became a bank, and therefore we're entitled to this 2-year window period where we get to divest ourselves of our non-conforming assets.
Well, Professor Broom, thanks so much for the explanation today.
My pleasure.
Lisa Broom directs the Center for Banking and Finance at the University of North Carolina School of Law. You may think tomorrow is just another Friday. Well, it's not. For teenage girls, tomorrow is all about twilight. Not as in the actual going down of the sun, but as in the teen vampire movie based on the series of best-selling books, as in the tens of millions in advance ticket sales, as in the posters and T-shirts and zillions of dollars in marketing tie-ins. That kind of spending frenzy may seem surprising given the times. But as Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports, even in a dark economy, the teen movie market still delivers a whole lot of bite.
For those of you unfamiliar with the saga of shy teenage Bella and her dreamy vampire boyfriend, Edward, I will let 13-year-old Izzy sum it up.
They're all about love. They're really, really deep and they're really sweet. Twilight's just, oh my God, it's amazing.
Sales have been amazing, too. Hundreds of theaters are already sold out for opening day, and the Twilight soundtrack is the top download on iTunes. Goth retailer Hot Topic is making a killing on Twilight T-shirts, posters, and wristbands at a time when most stores are bleeding red ink. Adrian Tennant is a consumer analyst for FBR Capital Markets.
The only way a consumer is going to part with their dollar is if there is something that they desperately want, and to have this pandemonium around Twilight, that's driving the actual sale.
Tennant says the teen market is worth about $100 billion, and Twilight has tapped into an especially rich vein. Teenage girls are behind the phenomenal success of Hannah Montana, Disney's High School Musical series, and bands like the Jonas Brothers.
The girls at that age are very vocal. They have a lot of say with regard to where household income will be spent.
And according to 13-year-old Izzy, Twilight's heartthrob vampire makes it easy to part with your allowance.
Your skin is pale white and ice cold.
Say it.
Vampire.
Are you afraid?
No.
Oh my God, he's like gorgeous. I have like 10 pictures of him. This one and then
Izzy also has tickets for the show tomorrow, right after school. In Los Angeles, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Coming up, struggling in a Congolese mine.
I begin losing hope because I have the impression that things are getting wrong.
But first, let's do the numbers. Welcome to the slaughterhouse. The Dow Jones Industrial Average sheared off 5.5%, 444 points, to close at 7,552. That's 7,552. The Nasdaq gave back 5%, 70 points, to end at 1316. The S&P dropped 6.75, 54 points, to close at 752. Financial stocks took a body blow. Citigroup plunged more than 26% on concerns that the recession will push up corporate bankruptcies. J.P. Morgan Chase threw off more than 17%, and Morgan Stanley unloaded 10.25%. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to just 3.01%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constellation Energy, working to provide responsible, sustainable energy to power America's future. Constellation Energy, the way energy works.
Thank you.
Want more from Marketplace's special fallout coverage? It's all on our website. You'll find special podcasts, videos, and the Marketplace Decoder, a simple guide to financial terms and products. Go to marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. President Bush arrives in Peru for the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit. The National Center for Technology Innovation wraps up its 2008 Innovators Conference in Washington. This year's agenda focuses on thriving in a global marketplace. And 850 cats claw their way to the top at the CFA International Cat Show. Felines fiercely compete for 3 days. Sounds perfect. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdal. Today, Barnes & Noble reported bigger losses than expected, 34 cents a share for the third quarter. Sales fell more than 4% in yet another sign of the publishing industry's troubles. But you can still get a book deal as long as you have a first name and occupation that become famous in a presidential campaign. Joe the Plumber is penning a book on American values, due out December 1st. Commentator and author Megan Husted says she's neither surprised nor upset that much of the publishing industry is on life support.
What I'm about to say qualifies as one of the dumbest professional moves I've made. You see, I've published a book and I hope to publish another one. But I must confess that when I hear the news about various publishing companies' struggles, I think to myself, hallelujah, can't wait till they all go under. Don't get me wrong, I hope people keep reading, and reading, yes, actual books, for decades to come. I just don't believe that today's publishing industry is at all equipped to deliver that bright future. In fact, many of their practices put the business in jeopardy. Rampant consolidation has meant pressure to achieve higher and higher margins. So how do publishers trim budgets? Well, no editor I know actually edits at the office. They're far too busy with administrative stuff. Publicists routinely are asked to promote more titles than they have time to read. High overhead cash-strapped publishers take shortcuts, and that means a lot of half-baked books wind up on store shelves. Industry insiders describe this as the throw spaghetti at the wall and see what sticks business model. Today's major publishers consistently release more product than they can and do support in a noisy, increasingly crowded marketplace. This doesn't do authors, or what business leaders today might want to call content providers, any favors. The value added by, say, an experienced editor is notoriously difficult to determine. So it's likely the scrimping will continue. Can you prove to a CFO's satisfaction that an extra 40 hours of editing leads to a 20% boost in sales volume? No, you can't. Though I really hope an MBA student somewhere is putting his or her mind to it. Whoever figures out a way to quantify these variables should get a Nobel Prize for Literature. But until then, writers and readers would be better served by smaller, more nimble outfits. Let's let the big houses topple and clear ground for some innovators.
Megan Husted's new book is called How to Be Useful. She lives in New York City. Got something useful for us? Go to marketplace.org and click on contact. Your cell phone or laptop wouldn't work without a mineral called columbite tantalum, coltan for short. And the growing demand for it in the West has ramifications in some pretty distant corners of the world, including the Democratic Republic of Congo, where we go for the latest profile in our series, Working. The global economy is about more than just big companies and maximizing profit. Once you strip all that away, it's about a single person doing a job, trying to get by. Reporter Gregory Warner visited Congo, where about 80% of the world's coltan is found, and where you'll find military and rebel factions vying for control of an industry worth hundreds of millions of dollars, while the miners themselves are barely scraping by.
Here's how you find Fidel Musafiri. First, you walk for 2 days through the jungle, until you come to a mountain scarred with sandy pits and dotted with little black tunnels. Climb down a log ladder into one of the tunnels, turn on your flashlight, and walk to the end. And there you find him, perched on a narrow ledge over a dark shaft, a small guy with no shirt on and a big headlamp, pounding a steel spike into a little hole in the rock. In Swahili, Fidel tells me his fantasy, that he has a jackhammer. No one has one this far into the jungle, of course. And without it, the work is painfully slow.
Hammering for hours and hours.
It's not only a jackhammer he's missing. Fidel doesn't have anything that a miner might want, like a hard hat, or insurance, or engineers, or geologists to guide the work. Fidel is what's called an artisanal miner, a freelancer. He digs a hole, sticks in dynamite, explodes it, and then hopes for mineral in the rubble. He works for the tunnel owner. He keeps just a cut of what he finds.
No one knows what is under the ground. No, it depends on God.
Who taught you how to do this work? How did you learn?
Apato. Just here. There is no school for this.
Fidel's now 35 years old. He walked here 6 years ago from a village 300 miles away. He lives with his wife and daughter now at the base of the mountain, but he hasn't been home in a week. He slept here, on the rock. His bed is a crushed plastic jug. Fidel tells me his wife prefers it this way.
Do I go back home with empty pockets? My sleeping here encourages my wife. She knows since my husband didn't come, so he's looking for money.
Fidel dreams of reaching what miners call a clean board. That's a rock face of pure mineral. Then he'd have lots to sell. Fidel's friend Kumani says, a clean board means money.
Our wishes that we are in front of a board. Then we are bosses and we are happy.
Fidel says, yeah, a clean board does attract the buyers. But it also brings the soldiers, former rebels that now wear government uniforms but still control the mine like mafiosi. They take a cut of the minerals that leave the mine. And more recently, they've started going into the tunnels with guns, forcing out the workers and mining themselves. If they leave Fidel's tunnel alone for now, it's only because he hasn't found enough profitable rock.
They can come and take what they can take, and they leave us what they leave. There is no other choice.
When Fidel needs a stretch or a bite to eat, he steps outside the tunnel. Merchants are there in booths made of wood poles and plastic sheeting. They sell corned beef and also fried bread and cheap gin and headlamps and radios and fancy pointy shoes. But Fidel just buys a plate of hot rice and beans and hops back into the tunnel. He already owes these merchants way too much money for the dynamite he's going to use in the work. But if you go past the merchants, you'll find the buyers with their metal scales. And then the soldiers demanding a smoke.
Can you keep us walking?
And the farther you climb down the muddy path, trying not to slip off the cliff or into one of the open pits, it's like a labyrinth, crowded with shirtless young workers, their skin caked with mud from tunnels, some of them drunk or fighting, or watching French films on a TV hooked to a generator. And drinking more, and all this continues through the night. So that even from your campsite in the jungle, in your sleeping bag with the insects all around, you can still hear, from far off, the noise of the men and their shouts. Back in the tunnel the next morning, Fidel seems giddy, like after an all-nighter. I find him dumping rocks onto a plastic jug. Actually, that's his bed. He'd exploded the dynamite last night and blasted loose about 100 pounds of coltan. He bangs off the impurities with a spike. With rocks in his hand, Fidel sits taller. He shouts for a trader to come buy some of his mineral. What's keeping him? Tell him to move it. Finally, the trader does come, bringing his scale, and Fidel measures off 2 kilos, $6. Companies in China or India will pay six times that much once a long string of middlemen have taken their cut. Then Fidel stands. He says he has to go to base camp, where his wife and daughter live, because there he can sell the coltan for a bit more per kilo. So we set off down the trail, with Fidel out in front, with his gray cowboy hat, and behind him a wrinkled porter carrying the bag of mineral, strapped to a big sled on his back. And the trouble starts almost as soon as we leave the tunnel. First, a teenager in a Houston Rockets jersey demands a dollar for some kind of census. We get past that one, but then a military officer tries to arrest Fidel for no apparent crime other than walking with a bag of mineral. And Fidel does not look surprised. He doesn't even say anything. I'm the one who has to plead with the officer.
Because if you arrest him now, it's going to become a big production, because you're going to go to the commander, it's going to be a big...
Finally, we're allowed to go, but it's late afternoon by the time we cross the river into the settlement. Fidel rents just a piece of a house, a room about the size of a horse stable. There's no door, just a curtain. There's no chair and no room for one. The mud wall has holes that let in the sunlight and the noise. And on the bed, there's his wife, and she's not speaking.
Is she sick?
This was not the homecoming that I'd expected. Her lips are chapped, her eyes are sunken. She has malaria, and she's malnourished. If she doesn't get help soon, she'll die. Fidel just takes her hand and sits down at the edge of the bed.
You haven't been home in a week, and she's been sick this whole time?
Yes. The whole week she has been suffering.
Fidel looks down, helpless, not at all like the man I met back in the tunnel, smiling with tools in his hands. Even with the bag of coltan he's earned this week, some of that money is for his boss, some to buy more dynamite. The rest just pays for food. There's no money for a doctor.
I begin losing hope because I have the impression that things are getting wrong. So I'm getting a bit pessimistic.
As I left, I asked Fidel if he had any regrets spending the last 6 years in the mine. I know it's a tough question, but he said no. He'd made his choice. And tomorrow, when the sun rises, he'd go back to his tunnel, pick up his hammer and his spike, and keep searching for that clean board.
Gregory Warner reporting from the Democratic Republic of Congo. Our series, Working, is a collaboration with Homelands Productions. For pictures of Fidel and audio from all of our working profiles, go to marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by CSX, whose trains move a ton of freight 423 miles on 1 gallon of fuel to help reduce emissions. CSX, how tomorrow moves. And by Putnam Investments, offering more of what you want in a retirement plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And this final note, okay, I got one for you. Here you go. What do you call a Yugo's shock absorbers? Passengers! Okay, here, I got another one for you. What do you call a Yugo at the top of the hill? A miracle! Well, the time for miracles has come to an end. Today, the automaker Zastava rolled out the last Yugo out of its plant in Serbia.
The 87 Yugo GV is still only $39.90. Call 1-800-USA-YUGO for the dealer nearest you.
Everybody needs a Yugo sometime.
Yeah, actually, they didn't. Yugos first hit the U.S. market in 1986 and lasted all of about 6 years here. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow fell 444 points, 5.5%. The NASDAQ dropped 70 points, 5%. And the S&P 500 lost 54 points, 6.75%. Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Next time on the program, we decode why trading continues once the markets close.
The intrinsic value of a stock is constantly moving, whether the market is open or not. And people want to access the market when the intrinsic value is changing.
I'm Tess Vigeland. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI?
I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.